Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Two killed during drug eradication in Pakistan. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says two local employees at the U.S. consulate in the northern Pakistani city of Peshawar were killed in an explosion during a drug eradication mission. Mr. Kerry told a gathering at the State Department today that he awakened to the news that the pair were killed along with an unknown number of Pakistani soldiers when an improvised explosive device detonated while on an effort to eradicate narcotics fields. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad said Tuesday the cessation of hostilities in his country's five-year war is a glimmer of hope. In a German television interview, President Assad said his government will do its part to make the truce work. There was a noticeable uptick in violation claims on Monday. Meanwhile, the UN aid partners began humanitarian deliveries. The United Nations Refugee Agency warns Europe is on the verge of an explosive self-induced humanitarian crisis. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The agency reports the number of refugees and migrants in Greece in need of shelter has soared to 24,000. This, it says, includes around 8,500 people stranded near the border with Macedonia. Vincent Costel is UNHCR's Refugee Crisis in Europe coordinator. He says the congestion at border crossings along the Balkan migratory route is leading to frustration among the migrants and refugees.
They don't understand that they can no longer move onward, that they have to queue, they have to go through the relocation process for those eligible for relocation, and it's not everybody. So there's a lot of frustration building up, which may lead to act of violence.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA News. With results in, Iranian voters dealt hardliners in both Parliament and the Assembly of Experts an electoral setback on Friday. But analyst Nabil Khoury of the Atlantic Council says whether it signals a change in direction of the Islamic Republic is not yet clear.
Clearly, reformists have made gains in this election, but whether or not this is a historic turning for the whole republic remains to be seen.
No single faction holds a majority, but state television reported Monday that moderate President Hassan Rouhani and his allies won 15 out of 16 seats in the election for the assembly. Reformers who favor social freedoms and engagement with the West won at least 85 seats in parliament, while moderate conservatives who also favor Iran's nuclear agreement with six world powers won 73, giving the two groups a majority in the 290-seat parliament. The UN Security Council is expected to vote Tuesday on a resolution that would impose new sanctions on North Korea in response to its latest nuclear and ballistic missile tests. It calls for a total arms embargo, a mandatory inspection of all cargo, and halts imports of all products that could be used for military purposes. Samantha Power, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, said the resolution would break new ground and represent the strongest set of sanctions imposed by the Security Council in more than two decades. U.S. President Barack Obama Monday presented the Medal of Honor. It's the nation's highest military achievement to senior Chief Special Warfare Operator Edward Byers for his bravery in rescuing a hostage from Taliban fighters in Afghanistan. At a special ceremony in the White House, the president described how Byers and his team of Navy SEALs helicoptered into Afghanistan in December of 2012 under the cover of darkness to rescue a hostage.
The American hostage later described the scene. The dark room suddenly filled with men and the sound of exploding gunfire. Narrow beams of light shot in every direction. Voices called out his name. He answered, "I'm right here." Hearing English, Ed leapt across the room and threw himself on the hostage, using his own body to shield him from the bullets. Another enemy fighter appeared, and with his body, Ed kept shielding the hostage. With his bare hands, Ed pinned the fighter to the wall and held him until his teammates took action.
The rescued hostage, Dr. Dilip Joseph, was unharmed and returned safely to his family. We call it Super Tuesday here in the U.S. That's because 11 states today head to the election polls in a series of primary elections to amass delegates for both the Republican and the Democratic Party. The frontrunners, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehine Swoohee. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The United Nations Refugee Agency warns Europe is on the verge of an explosive, self-induced humanitarian crisis, which could spiral out of control and result in widespread violence.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva. Details next.
Also in the news in Burundi, three bodies have been found so far in what has been called a mass grave in the capital, Bujumbura. And the global drop in the price of crude has battered Nigeria's economy.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Liberia in our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour in Burundi, three bodies have been found so far in what has been called a mass grave in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura. The grave was reported yesterday in the northwestern Mutakura district. Officials had said as many as 30 bodies might be buried there. The mayor of Bujumbura, Freddie Mbonimpa, says youths opposed to the Nkurunziza government informed police about the mass grave after they were arrested last week. The discovery preceded today's arrival of three UN human rights investigators. They're scheduled to visit Burundi through March 8th. In other news on Burundi, 17 regional civil society organizations say the country's crisis is not on the agenda of the upcoming East Africa Community Heads of State Summit. It is scheduled to begin tomorrow in Arusha, Tanzania. The civil society groups are calling for an independent body to investigate all claims of human rights abuses.
The United Nations Refugee Agency warns Europe is on the verge of an explosive self-induced humanitarian crisis which could spiral out of control and result in widespread violence. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The agency reports the number of refugees and migrants in Greece in need of shelter has soared to 24,000. This, it says, includes around 8,500 people stranded near the border with Macedonia. It says the crowded conditions are leading to shortages of food, shelter, water, and sanitation. Vincent Costel is UNHCR's Refugee Crisis in Europe coordinator. He says the congestion at border crossings along the Balkan migratory route is leading to frustration among the migrants and refugees.
They don't understand that they can no longer move onward, that they have to queue, they have to go through the relocation process for those eligible for relocation, and it's not everybody. So there's a lot of frustration building up, which may lead to act of violence.
A peaceful protest Monday near the Macedonian border turned violent as people threw tear gas canisters to force refugees and migrants away from the razor wire fence. Nearly 132,000 people, half of them women and children, have made the perilous Mediterranean Sea crossing this year, exceeding the total for the first half of 2015. Almost all have landed in Greece. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says the European Union must absolutely go through with the plan it approved last year for an equitable relocation of refugees among its 28 members.
It should concern everyone that despite commitments to relocate 66,400 refugees from Greece, states have so far pledged only 1,539 spaces and only 325 actual relocations have occurred.
The UNHCR says Greece must urgently increase its ability to accommodate and support the masses of people arriving, and that more resources and better coordination among EU member states are critical. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. In other migrant news, for a second day, French authorities raised parts of a migrant camp near Calais called the Jungle. The French news agency says shacks and shelters are being taken down by hand, but bulldozers are standing by. They had been used yesterday to level parts of the camp. There were clashes yesterday between police and migrants who do not want to be moved. The camp offers migrants and refugees opportunities to sneak aboard trucks and ferries heading for Britain. Also, Reuters reports that the European Union's top court has issued a ruling on the relocation of migrants. It says some can be told where they must live in Europe, as long as the reason is to help them integrate into society. The ruling applies to migrants with so-called subsidiary protection. That means they do not qualify as refugees, but are in need of protection. The EU Court of Justice says, in general, migrants with protected status should be allowed to move freely.
British Defence Secretary Michael Fallon says he is sending a training team of about 20 soldiers to Tunisia to help prevent people from crossing illegally from neighbouring Libya. Islamic State fighters have expanded their presence in Libya as two rival governments failed in efforts to unite and form a strong central authority. That has raised concerns about Islamic State launching attacks from Libya and entering Tunisia, which has already experienced several deadly attacks targeting tourists and government officials. Fallon told Parliament that Britain is ready to provide training and military advice to Libya, but has no current plans to send ground troops for combat operations.
Two UN agencies report that 3 years of conflict and ongoing displacements in the Central African Republic continue to disrupt agriculture and severely constrain people's access to food. The Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, and the World Food Programme, WFP, warn that as people in the CAR struggle with poor harvest, disrupted markets, and soaring prices for many staple foods, the food security situation remains dire. Benvenu Diosa is the WFP country director for CAR. He says half of the population there faces severe hunger, and without emergency assistance, they will not survive.
Of course, we are very much concerned about the food security situation of CAR right now, because our latest food security emergency assessment disclosed that half of the population of CAR is facing food insecurity at the moment. And this figure is globally 30% higher than what it was last year. When I say last year, I'm talking about 2014, because our report was released in late 2015. Then we have acute food insecurity that rose by, I would say, fivefold higher than in 2014. So it's a serious problem, very critical for the population right now.
What is being done to help improve the situation so that people get nutritious food that they need?
We keep assisting. In addition to the traditional activity that we carry out, we also focus on resilience, meaning that we try to find the type of assistance that can help the population not only release from their hunger, but also create the basis for them to cater for their own needs. But we have a food distribution system. We have cash-based transfer to the population, depending on the market suitability. And we have, most importantly, innovative activities such as P4P, Purchase for Progress, is a type of activity whereby we buy food from small farmers to redeploy for our other activities such as education, food, school meals in the schools.
Looking at the long-term situation of continued poor harvest, what is being done in this area to help?
For us, as WFP, we work on reduction of vulnerability of the population. We promote resilience, and we also, of course, on a daily basis, try to make sure that the vulnerable population, they have nutritious food, particularly for those who are most vulnerable, like children and their wives, lactating women, or pregnant women.
So far, the insecurity in the area has displaced some 900,000 people. So what is being done to help try to bring the people back, or will they ever come back?
We have a recovery program. And now that the political situation seems to be easing a bit, the humanitarian community is working on a strategy to help people return back to their homes. This has to be a package. It can't be only food. Because for people to return back to their home, they have to make sure that there is security in their homes. They would like to know that they will not have to undergo any threat again. But then WFP can accompany this process with food for resilient income-generating activities. What is being done, the answer will lie in the hands of entire humanitarian community, and I'm sure we are working very hard on it right now.
Bienvenu Jossa is the WFP country director in CAR. He spoke with me from Bangui.
Fifteen past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Judges at the International Criminal Court in The Hague began considering arguments today on whether to open the court's first ever war crimes trial targeting the destruction of religious or cultural heritage. Malian citizen Ahmed Al-Faki Al-Mahdi is accused of overseeing 2012 attacks on cherished religious sites in Mali's ancient city of Timbuktu. From Paris, Lisa Bryan has more.
Thank you, Madam President. Ahmed Al-Faki Al-Mahdi, born in Agoun, Mali.
The hearing was unprecedented for a court better known for judging crimes such as rape, killing, and sexual slavery. On Tuesday, judges at the International Criminal Court instead considered whether there was enough evidence to bring to trial another kind of crime, the destruction of cultural and religious heritage. Former trainee teacher and alleged jihadist Ahmed Al-Faki Al-Mahdi is accused of planning and leading the destruction of nine mausoleums and the door of an ancient mosque in the northern Malian city of Timbuktu in June and July of 2012. All but one of the buildings were designated United Nations World Heritage Sites. Timbuktu is known as the City of 333 Saints and has been an important trading and religious hub for centuries. In opening remarks before a pre-trial chamber, ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda argued the mausoleum's demolition by Islamist radicals amounts to nothing less than the destruction of the soul and history of a community and a loss for the world.
What is at stake here is not just walls and stones. The destroyed mausoleums were important from a religious point of view, from an historical point of view, and from an identity point of view. Such an attack against buildings dedicated to religion and historic monuments falls into the category of crimes that destroy the roots of an entire people and profoundly and irremediably affect its social practices and structures.
The prosecution claims Al-Mahdi, an ethnic Tuareg who is believed to be in his 30s, led a morality squad in Timbuktu and was a member of militant group Ansar Din, an ally of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. The Islamists captured Timbuktu in May 2012, imposing a harsh rule on the local population before French soldiers finally drove them out almost a year later. Al-Mahdi appeared to listen carefully to the prosecution's arguments. He sported long hair, a beard, and spectacles. He spoke briefly, saying he understood the charges against him. He has previously denied them, and his lawyers will make his case during the hearing. Besides the Timbuktu monuments, the Islamic State militant group's destruction of temples in Syria's ancient town of Palmyra, and the Taliban's 2001 demolition of massive Buddha statues in Afghanistan have also sparked global outcry. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The global drop in the price of crude has battered Nigeria's economy, slowing economic growth and cutting into government revenue. During his recent visit to the Middle East, President Muhammadu Buhari called for action to stabilize prices. But analysts say there's little Nigeria can do to influence countries like Saudi Arabia to cut production. Chris Stein reports from Lagos.
Oil was on Buhari's mind as he visited the Middle East in recent days. In a meeting with the ruler of Qatar Saturday, he called the low price of crude totally unacceptable. He said fellow members of the OPEC cartel need to work together to stabilize the price. Global oil prices have collapsed since 2014. The price of a barrel is hovering around $35, compared to more than $100 just 2 years ago. One way to raise the price of oil would be to decrease production, but top oil producers have been unwilling to do that. An analyst with London-based Energy Aspects, Ridoy Rashid, says Saudi Arabia would have to take the lead on any cut in OPEC production.
Saudi Arabia is unwilling to cut output unilaterally to support the market and is extremely skeptical of other countries, including Nigeria, that they'd ever deliver on promises to reduce production.
Saudi Arabia was also on Buhari's itinerary. While there, Buhari said Nigeria is paying the price for failing to diversify from oil revenue and called for developing the country's agriculture and mining sectors. In a statement, Buhari's office said he and the Saudi leader had committed to doing all that is possible to rebound oil prices. But analyst Hans Locher of Vienna-based Raiffeisen Bank International says Nigeria isn't interested in cutting its own production because of threats from militants and oil thieves.
I don't think that they really will do this. They have plenty of problems with their pipeline attack in their country.
OPEC members are scheduled to meet later this month, where they are expected to mull a cap on production. But Locher says that will only be effective if all countries abide by it, and Iran has given indications that it will not. If the oil price is to rise, Locher says it will likely be buoyed by strong economic growth in emerging markets such as China, which has recently faced slow growth rates and tumult in its stock exchanges. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 21 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. In Burundi, three bodies have been found so far in what has been called a mass grave in the capital, Bujumbura. The United Nations Refugee Agency warns Europe is on the verge of an explosive, self-induced humanitarian crisis. And the global drop in the price of crude has battered Nigeria's economy. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The former heir apparent to Zimbabwe's long-ruling President Robert Mugabe has launched a new political party. Joyce Mujuru announced the formation of the Zimbabwe People First Party today at a news conference in the capital, Harare. Mujuru, who's 60 years old, served as Mr. Mugabe's vice president from 2004 until her ouster 10 years later. She had held several party and government posts before ascending to the vice presidency. Mujuru was removed in 2014 after Mugabe's wife, Grace, said she was lining up factions within the ZANU-PF party to topple Mr. Mugabe from power. President Mugabe, who recently turned 92, has ruled Zimbabwe since the country gained independence in 1980.
Zimbabwe is one of the four Southern African countries rolling out free HIV self-testing kits this month. Experts say making it easier for people to find out their status will curb the spread of HIV, but others worry that testing without adequate counseling and treatment options will have little impact. Sebastian Mumfu reports from Harare.
Zimbabwe is optimistic that self-testing kits can help it prevent new HIV infections. A quick thumb prick, and in a matter of minutes, the test kit can tell you if you are HIV positive or not. The test kits are already available in some pharmacies. They cost about $5. But a new program funded by the international NGO Unitaid will soon begin distributing them for free over the next 4 years, so researchers can evaluate their effectiveness. Zimbabwe's National HIV Prevention Coordinator, Gertrude Ncube, says the self-testing kits are convenient and discreet.
When you look at self-testing, it has got an advantage in saying that those who are even afraid of maybe for someone to know their HIV status, they'll be able to test themselves and interpret the results themselves at their home environment. Basing on other studies which have been done somewhere like in Malawi, it was found that men were actually forthcoming with self-testing. So we are hoping that even here in Zimbabwe, especially men who are always busy at work, they'll be able to get the self-tests and test themselves.
Only 34% of men in Zimbabwe know their HIV status compared to 56% for women. In some African countries, the percentage of men who know their HIV status can be as low as 8%. In theory, once people know they're infected, they can begin treatment and learn how not to transmit the virus to others. But some Zimbabweans are skeptical. The self-test kits are not a magic bullet, says Maya Maponga.
As soon as I get to know my results, what do I do from then? There is no adequate counseling. Let's not just assume that everybody is in the know about HIV. Yes, we want to take it like we want to normalize HIV, but in the process, it's not that like as normal as we would want it to be.
Stefano Goodcare works with Population Services International, one of the organizations running the HIV self-testing program in Zimbabwe.
Community health workers, they are going to be available to assist people that might test regardless of their results. If they need further information, they need support, even assistance with interpreting their own results or what options they can follow after testing. We also have a toll-free line that people can call and speak to a counselor at any time, and this should be able to provide further support to people that test.
Malawi, South Africa, and Zambia are also taking part in this initiative. At the moment, Kenya is only other African country to have officially adopted HIV self-testing kits, though they can be found for purchase in other countries like Namibia and Tanzania. Of the approximately 34 million HIV-positive people worldwide, 69% live in sub-Saharan Africa. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yeheyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more. Coming up next right here on The Voice of America. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. We'll discuss the beauty of Africa with me, Esther Githui Ewart, as guest host. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Bratty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. In Burundi, three bodies have been found so far in what has been called a mass grave in the capital, Bujumbura. The United Nations Refugee Agency warns Europe is on the verge of an explosive self-induced humanitarian crisis. Coming up, music from Liberia and a look at Ethiopia's worst drought in 50 years. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are beginning with Olympic news today.
Kim, the International Olympic Committee's executive board opened a three-day meeting Tuesday in Lausanne, Switzerland. Among the issues to be discussed are Rio de Janeiro's preparations for the Olympic Games in August. There are more than a few concerns, including ticketing, the Zika outbreak, and severe water pollution. Joining us now from Rio with an update is our friend Luis Piazza. Sporty Olympic greetings, Luis.
Sporty Olympic greetings, Sonny. Yes, the ticket came up this week, past. As the last Friday ended the Diving World Cup, qualifying for the Summer Games, near all the tickets put for sales were bought out. It was also a chance, according to the organizers, to make important tests. First, it was on the very swimming pool center newly built, where the Olympic Games will take place. 88 athletes jumped from as high as 33 feet for medals and qualification. Second, it was the first opportunity to see the Security Olympic Task Force at work. A total of 300 agents from the National Force, plus city and state police and fire officers, traffic agents, including the use of drones as a surveillance aid. A source told us that an intelligence team monitored 24/7 potential illegal ticket activities related to the Olympics, aiming to avoid what happened in the recent Soccer FIFA World Cup, a £58 million ticket racket. In the meantime, last Wednesday, 24th, the Associated Press distributed to the international media a note that we don't see a single line of it in any Brazilian media outlet, says the title of the note. Organizers of the Rio de Janeiro Olympics have decided to scrap assigned seat tickets in certain sections at some sports and venues, including the main stadium. On the same day, the House of Representatives in Brazil approved the final bill to become the Olympic Act, after the sanction by the president. The act will secure 4% of the tickets for disabled people. We tried to hear the Olympic Committee Director of Communication responsible for ticketing. No reply. Until then, the sales have been done online since October last year. We spoke with a Paralympic athlete, very representative per se, Guilherme Borrajo, the only para-athlete in the Brazilian sitting voting team who was athlete before becoming amputee of one leg in a bus accident, exactly when he was coming out of a match in Maracanã Stadium in 2008. Guilherme could be placed as a super-athlete, compete volley, taekwondo, and Hawaiian canoe, champion and gold medalist in many international tournaments, with three Paralympics under his belt. Hear what he says about chances and obstacles he and the Brazilian team will face.
Thank you. My pleasure to speak for Voice of America's Sony side of sport. The Brazilian Saints are very good. We can play for the gold. Our national city volleyball Paralympic team is very strong and confident. And our responsibility is the highest because we are 3 times Pan American champion. 2007 in Rio, 2011 in Guadalajara, Mexico, and 2015 in Toronto, Canada. 2 silver in the World Para Volley Championship in Oklahoma, USA, and again silver in Sarajevo Open. Now I talk about the obstacles. They are, first, the money put into Paralympics don't go directly to athletes. At least some should go. We need in order to keep training and living on the sport. Second, the mobility obstacles, the streets of Rio and place we need to assess. It is very hard to move around.
And this was my report, Luis Piazet from Rio for the Sony side of sports.
You asked for it and we answered. The Sunny Side of Sports is expanding our showtime on VOA Africa.
In African club football, one Zimbabwean side advanced over the weekend, while the other suffered a heartbreaking ouster in continental competition. Michael Cariati reports from Harare.
There were mixed fortunes for Zimbabwe's representatives in Pan-African football, as Chicken Inwe eliminated from the CAF Champions League, while Harare City progressed to the first round of the CAF Confederation Cup. For Chicken Inwe, it was a cruel and haunting way to end their bold Africa campaign after conceding an injury time penalty to lose the match 2-0 to South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns and bow out of the tournament 2-1 on aggregate. The Gamecocks players felt cheated as they believed the penalty came after Passmore Bernard had impeded Kama Billiard in the box was not justified, a feeling which they share with their coach, Joey Antipas.
But I thought the penalty was a bit dodgy, but that's the nature of the game. I'll say Ari Sundowns all the best in their quest for African Champions League.
The Zimbabweans confronted Malagasy referee Antofetra Rakotogiano soon after the penalty was awarded, but the referee stood his ground before Katlego Mashego converted to give Sundowns the passage to the next round. Chicken Inn had matched the so-called Brazilians man for man and could also have won the game had Michel Cachairo's effort not cannoned off the post before Obadiah Tarumbwa missed the target with the goalkeeper to beat. Speaking on international sports television channel Supersport, Antipas praised the charges for a good show that saw them win a lot of admirers among the thousands of fans who braved the weather to watch the evening game.
I'll give the boys 100% for the big effort that they put in. For us to try and get a result, we had to put in a massive performance, and which they did. All in all, I'll say great performance from my boys.
Even Sundowns coach Pitso Mosimane admitted that Zimbabweans gave them a tough time and did high praise for the Castle Lager Premier Soccer League champions.
But credit to this team. This team is a very good team. These are not fishermen or from an island. This is serious football, and they gave us a time. What a tough game.
However, there was some consolation for Zimbabwe after Harare City cruised through to the first round proper of the CAF Confederation Cup with an impressive 3-1 away win over AS Adema of Madagascar. Harare City will now meet Zesco of Zambia. Reporting in Harare, this is Michael Cariati.
You crave more sports news? We're here to fulfill your wishes on VOA Africa. Listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Joining us once again on the Sunny Side of Sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Sunny.
David, let's go to Nairobi And a warm hello to all our Voice of America listeners tuning in on 107.5 FM in Nairobi, VOA's 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week FM station in the Kenyan capital. In Nairobi, a new football coach has been introduced. How about some details, David Legg?
Thank you, Sonny. And again, a warm welcome to all our Kenyan listeners. And it's Stanley Nkumi. He's taking over from Bobby Williamson. Well, Sonny, this is a change that's been a long time coming. I've lost track of the number of times I've spoken on your show and said, Bobby Williamson, he's skating on very thin ice and the sun is shining down on him hard. It just hasn't worked for him. And I think particularly disappointing was actually one of the successors of Bobby Williamson, because they went to Mauritius in the first round of the 2018 World Cup qualifiers. Against all expectations, they did really well and won 5-2. Then came the return match in Nairobi, and we were all expecting a goal avalanche of sorts. But I've never seen such woeful finishing, appalling shooting by the Harambee Stars. The match finished 0-0, and I thought to myself there and then, if Williamson cannot pull off a shock victory over Cape Verde in the next round, I believe he's a dead man walking. Well, what happened, Sonny, is Kenya actually did quite well at home to Cape Verde and won 1-0. But then, as so often happens in Kenya, unfortunately, a couple of officials put a spanner in the works, and instead of taking off in good time to travel across the width of Africa to the Cape Verde Islands off the west coast, there was various dramas. We leave it for diplomatic reasons at that for the moment. And it ended up with the Kenyans arriving just hours before the kickoff. And of course, the inevitable happened. A side not really properly prepared, they lost the return match 2-0 and were eliminated 2-1 in aggregate. So as far as Russia 2018 is concerned, it's all over for Kenya. Also, Sonny, in the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers, Williamson actually made a good start. He went to Congo Brazzaville and his side forced a 1-1 draw, a really creditable result against the 2015 quarterfinalists. But then, bingo, it always seems to happen this way with Kenyan football. Zambia come to Nairobi, Kenya score first, Zambia score twice, and Zambia win 2-1. So all the good work done by getting that away draw in Congo Brazzaville dissipated. And now Kenya, I must say, not really looking likely qualifiers for the 2017 Cup of Nations. In fact, you've got to go back, Sonny, to 2004 for the last time that the Harambee Stars graced Africa's showpiece event. So Bobby Williamson, he can have absolutely no complaints, although I do feel sorry for him. Insofar, Sonny, as reports indicate that he's owed $30,000 by the Kenyan football authorities, and I think that's extremely unfair, to say the least. But he's had his fair number of chances. He hasn't succeeded. So now let's see if Mr. Okumbi can spell some magic. Coming up in March, Sonny, Kenya will play Guinea-Bissau home and away. If the Harambee Stars can win both of those Cup of Nations qualifiers, well, they could yet prove me wrong, although they're in a group where I feel Congo Brazzaville or Zambia will qualify.
David, let's turn to African youth football now. Draws recently held at the under-17 and under-20 levels in the Africa Cup of Nations. New title there. Maybe you want to talk about that a bit, David.
Yes, Sonny, and I congratulate CAF. What they've done is they've standardized the names of the various competitions. At senior level, you've got the Africa Cup of Nations. For under-23s, you've got the Africa Under-23 Cup of Nations. And now the new titles of the youth and junior tournaments are the Africa Under-20 Cup of Nations and the Africa Under-17 Cup of Nations. And to me, that's very logical, very sensible, and well done, CAF. You see, CAF, we don't dislike you all the time. First of all, Sonny, the under-20 competition, as I scroll down, I see that the title holders, Nigeria, they've got a bye in the preliminary round, and in the first round proper, they will play Burundi or the Democratic Republic of Congo. And in the last under-20 African Championship, the runners-up were Senegal, and their first match will be against Tunisia or Niger. Turning to the under-17s, and the interesting thing here, Sonny, is that Nigeria, who only finished fourth in the 2015 African tournament, went on to become the world champions. And they will start off against Niger. And the African champions, Mali, they will start against DR Congo or Chad. Interesting scenario that only fourth best in Africa, but then under Emmanuel Amunike, the same Nigeria went on to win the World Championship. It was a great tournament, Sonny, for Africa in the sense that Mali also reached the final, and the Nigerians emerged victorious by 2-0. And that was the second consecutive world title for the Nigerians. So at under 17 level, Sonny, the Nigerians are a very formidable force. Clearly, they are the team to watch out for in the forthcoming qualifiers.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see a photo and article on Floyd Mayweather Jr., who stopped here in Washington the past couple of days. The American boxing star says he has no plans to fight again. Mayweather was in Washington to promote an April 1st bout between Adrian Broner and British boxer Ashley Theophone, who is in Mayweather's stable of fighters. Mayweather also attended a Washington Wizards basketball game and says looking forward, he would one day like to own a NBA club. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, Ethiopia hit by the worst drought in 50 years. But first, some music. Here is Queen from Liberia with Sweet Africa. from Liberia with Sweet Africa.
In Ethiopia, emergency aid for more than 10 million people hit by the worst drought in 50 years is expected to run out in the coming weeks unless donors step in with over $2 million of food aid, according to charity organization Save the Children. Lack of additional funds could mean a potentially catastrophic escalation in severe acute malnutrition, particularly among children. Paul Dorish is the director for the Development Strategy and Governance Division at the International Food Policy Research Institute. He explains to reporter Vincent McCorry how the Ethiopian government prepared for the severity of the drought.
This drought is especially severe, and the government of Ethiopia has made major strides in preparation for this kind of drought and for other natural disasters in the country.
Yeah. Now, were there plans that were made to at least reduce the impact of this drought? And if so, why have they not mitigated this effect?
Well, there's been a lot of progress in the safety nets in Ethiopia over the last 10 years or so. The Ethiopian government has instituted, along with the donors, a productive safety net program. And in that program, households are identified at the local level who are in need of food assistance over time. And food aid that comes into Ethiopia and other money from the Ethiopian government is targeted to these households. So that is in place, and that productive safety net program is being scaled up now. So that's a very good channel to deal with the effects of this drought at the household level. What's especially difficult about the effects of this drought, though, is that it's especially hit hard the eastern third of the country. And there's less than 10% of the population of Ethiopia living in that eastern third. But in those pastoralist areas, these households are dependent to a large extent on their livestock. There's some crop agriculture, but livestock have been very hard hit, and that means these households have been very hard hit by water shortages and so forth. The drought has affected the highlands as well, but it's particularly severe in the eastern third of the country.
Now, every time we mention drought, we also mention famine. Do they always have to go together? I mean, must there be hunger, famine, if there's drought?
No, and the good news is that there are things that can be done. A lot of lessons were learned from that very serious famine in the mid-1980s. One of the things is that the Ethiopian government, after that, made a big effort to invest in infrastructure, in the roads, in the telecommunications and so forth, that help move food from one place to the other, that let people know what the situation is. There's also been a big investment in agriculture over time. Ethiopia actually doubled its food production, its cereal production, in the last 10 years. So those things have been done. And then again, very importantly, getting the food to the households that are in need. This year, it's likely that cereal production will only be down perhaps 10%, but the people on that eastern third of the country are in definitely need that relief effort.
But what I'm hearing here, there is food in the rest of the country. There's only this small part of the country that doesn't have food. So is the problem just making that food available, or rather getting it to the needy people? Is that the biggest problem?
Broadly speaking, that is perhaps one of the biggest problems. There's also an issue of those of children, mothers who have severe nutritional problems because of this drought, because of a shortage of food.
But it means that somebody didn't act quick enough. I mean, there's food in other parts of the country. All was needed to be done is to transport that food and make sure those people get it in time, right?
Well, I think, broadly speaking, we're still in time.
Yeah.
The calls by the different NGOs, even the government, are to make sure that things don't get very bad 4 months from now. And so this aid that comes in is very, very important. But also, the households affected by the drought directly, I mean, that those households, that livestock, water is a big issue. It's not just cereal. It's not just supplemental feeding.
Paul Dorosh is the director for the Development Strategy and Governance Division at the International Food Policy Research Institute. He spoke with VOA's Vincent McCorry.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One of the key propaganda points ISIL uses to cozen converts to its cause is to claim that its so-called caliphate's expansion is inevitable. But recent ISIL setbacks in Iraq and in northeastern Syria, particularly in and near the strategically significant town of al-Shaddadi, once again expose the hollowness of that claim. In the last few days, local Syrian defense forces, supported by the U.S.-led coalition, have reclaimed territory in an area that was a critical ISIL base and have continued to liberate the population from ISIL's grip. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter said, "By encircling and taking this town, we're seeking to sever the last major northern artery between Raqqa and Mosul and ultimately dissect the parent tumor into two parts, one in Iraq and the other in Syria." Thousands of local fighters were involved in the effort to drive out ISIL from al-Shaddadi, said Brett McGurk, special presidential envoy for the global coalition to counter ISIL. They included Kurds, Sunni Arabs, Christians. Mr. McGurk used a metaphor to describe this, saying, "There's a lot of different groups that are kind of shards of wood that want to fight ISIL. It's our job to try to pull them together, not just in a bundle, but in a bat. And what you have going now towards Shaddadi is a baseball bat." In a recent address, President Barack Obama emphasized that the fight against ISIL remains difficult and complex. But he noted that efforts to squeeze ISIL's core in Syria and Iraq have borne fruit. With the help of coalition training, equipment, and support, ISIL has now lost a series of key Iraqi towns and cities, more than 40% of what it once controlled in Iraq, including the city of Ramadi. Its leaders have been killed. Its oil infrastructure has been targeted in airstrikes, leading to a significant reduction in ISIL's oil production. Its cash storage sites have been destroyed, resulting in the slashing of salaries for ISIL fighters. Since the summer, ISIL has not had a single successful major offensive operation in either Syria or Iraq. In the end, the brutality of ISIL is no match for the yearning of millions who want to live in security and dignity, said President Obama. "With allies and partners in the service of our dedicated personnel, we will destroy this barbaric terrorist organization and continue to stand with people across the region who seek a better and a safer future."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.